Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. We balance business understanding with technology innovation and human insight. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we'll be taking a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Giles Chapman, an award-winning writer on the history, industry and culture of cars and author of Mini 60 Years. Giles, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Now, we're going to chat about one of the more iconic motor cars ever produced, Giles, the Mini. The first vehicle rolled off the production lines in Oxford 60 years ago this week. And its history has mirrored the huge changes in British industry and indeed in British society over that 60-year period. But take us right back to the reason the Mini was first developed. It actually partly came out of a major strategic event in post-war British history, the Suez crisis and the threat that posed to fuel supplies for Britain.
That's absolutely right. We had a situation in the mid-50s where there was a big scare on the continued supply of fuel, all triggered by the Suez crisis in the Middle East. And what it caused initially was a big surge of interest in cars that could make a gallon of petrol go a very long way. So the resulting sort of boom in sales of little three-wheeled vehicles, the British ones tended to be powered by motorbike engines, and then we had a whole raft of interesting German vehicles coming over, being imported. They were known as bubble cars. They seemed to pose a big threat to the established car industry, and the company that sort of wanted to square up to this most was the British Motor Corporation, that is, the merger of Austin and Morris, the biggest car maker in the country at the time. So they decided to stop development of everything else they were doing and really come up with a vehicle that could, put the bubble cars in their place, really. The idea was to try and produce a very, very compact car with a small engine, but four cylinders and four seats and four wheels. So it would be a real car, only in miniature. And what they had in their armory was an amazing design genius, a guy called Alec Isigonis. He'd already created the Morris Minor, which, as you know, many people in the UK and Ireland will be familiar with, was a very popular car in the early 50s, big seller. And he was able to really negotiate with BNC that he would do it his way or not at all. He was regarded as such an expert that really he said, I'll produce a car for you, but you have to let me do it in the way I want to. And so he had quite a few of sort of technical innovations in his mind that he was going to push forward. The key one really being that the car would have front-wheel drive for excellent road holding. And in order to make it just 10 feet long, he put the engine crossways across the front of the car. So there was lots of space in the footprint of the vehicle to put the four people. In fact, the engine only really takes up 20% of the footprint of the Mini. And the rest of it's all devoted to, you know, passenger and luggage space, which today looks absolutely terrible, you know, really, really cramped. But at the time, it was amazing that you could get four people inside the what you'd call the envelope of the car.
And far more than four on many occasions, Giles.
Yeah.
And it really took off then in the 60s, particularly with urban drivers. And I suppose it reflected the swinging 60s in many ways, particularly in Britain. The sports version of it, the Mini Cooper, won all sorts of honours at Monte Carlo.
Indeed.
And of course, we had the glamour of its role in films.
Yeah, well, you're giving me a lot to unpack there. But what I will say first is the first thing it did was it undercut every other car on the market. So the Mini became one of the absolute cheapest and also one of the most high-tech cars you could buy. And because they'd recently in the UK relaxed hire purchase limitations, it really sort of led to an explosion of people buying a new car. What people discovered was it was very economical, very, very excellent performance. And then once they'd actually added even more to that with the Mini Cooper, because of the front-wheel drive handling, it could really kind of outpace every other vehicle on the racetrack. So it was an amazing race winner. This wasn't something Isagonis had ever planned. It was just something that John Cooper, the Formula One car constructor, had sort of wrecked an amazing piece of design. So all these things, the popularity of the car, its on-track image, the fact it won races, all this really led to it being, you know, getting this amazing image boost in the 1960s, a sort of halo effect, really, of all the things that were there. The other thing, of course, being in big city, was it was very, very nimble, and you could park it in a front garden, you know, really where you could get no other car in. So a lot of factors all came together, became very, very trendy, and it actually got celebrity endorsement.
And the best marketing job for those who hadn't seen it, in terms of its nimbleness in an urban environment, Giles, its star role in the Italian Job.
The Italian Job, yeah, that's right. Well, it's absolutely synonymous with that. You know, that's 10 years after the Mini was launched, so it was quite an old product at that time. And I think the producers of that film, they had a lot of dismay with BMC in those days, because they wouldn't really supply cars at cost. So they used 30 Minis in the making of that film, and they were all smashed to pieces. And although BMC let them have 6, the other 24 all had to be basically bought at local dealers at, you know, full price. Because as the producer says, you know, that movie was the most exciting and longest car commercial that's ever been created. But he was absolutely insistent that they had to be Minis as part of that, as you said earlier, that sort of swinging London kind of trendiness that was in there. Fiat were very happy to let them use Fiat, because, as we know, it was all set in Italy. But the producer said, no, it's got to be Mini Coopers. And that all really was redolent of all the things that the Mini had achieved in the 60s, which included winning the Monte Carlo Rally 3 times. So, you know, the film producer could see all the potential of the character of the Mini, even though, in a way, what was weird, the car manufacturer couldn't really see that. You know, I mean, they in a way, they didn't really know what they had. Then the Mini sort of goes into the 1970s, and it suffers from almost like 10 years of complete neglect. They're still making the car. And in fact, the most successful year is 1971, where they make over 300,000 Minis in total, which is, you know, the peak of production. But, you know, at this point, it's part of British Leyland, which is a well-known, you know, industrial basket.
Yeah, let's talk about the 1970s, Giles, because the British Motor Corporation merges into British Leyland as part of consolidation in the industry. And even on this side of the water, British Leyland, unfortunately, has that brand as of I suppose, the sick industrial relations in Britain in the 1970s. The Mini was a victim of that as well.
Well, it wasn't a victim. In some ways, it was a victim because they'd never had any capital to replace the car with. So it just continued in production almost unaltered. But, you know, conversely, that was in a way its saving grace, because everybody knew the Mini. It was a known quantity. All the kind of quality and design problems have been ironed out. And it was very cheap. So, you know, right through the 1970s, although British Leyland was a bit of a mess, the Mini that they were making was just perfect for the times, because, you know, we then had another fuel crisis. So, you know, although it was born out of the fuel crisis, it then benefits in its midlife from everybody, you know, wanting to make fuel go as far as possible. So, it is amazing. I mean, when it gets to 1979 and it's 20 years old, you think of that now. There are no cars on sale that have been around for 20 years anymore. It just seemed to sort of somehow sail on. And, you know, even when they tried to replace it with the Metro in 1980, they kept making the Mini anyway. And in fact, the Metro then fell away and the Mini was still going. So you could still buy a new one in the year 2000, which for a car conceived in the mid-50s and still with a mid-1950s engine, it's quite extraordinary. You know, it was the sort of cult object they couldn't kill.
And we then move on to, I suppose, the second coming of the British motor industry, but this time under foreign ownership. The Japanese move in with Honda coming in the late 70s, and British Leyland or the Rover part of it taken over by the Germans in 1984 with BMW.
94, actually.
Oh, 94. Apologies.
It was a little bit later than that. Yeah, but they did try and exponentially expand their business by taking Rover on. It was a bit of a disaster. But the one thing that they kept from the wreckage of all of their failed industrial expansion was to keep hold of the Mini, keep hold of the name and the image. And then they created a brand new car, which they called the Mini, and, you know, is a Mini because it draws on a lot of the kind of the love for the old one. But it was really a completely new vehicle. And, you know, you do actually have this interesting, what I feel is you have two bunches of Mini enthusiasts. You've got people who love the old car who hate the new one, and people who love the new car who don't really understand the old one. So, you know, but I mean, indeed, that's now almost 20 years ago, and they've made a huge success of it. And they've replaced the Mini three different times, always with a car that captures the, you know, lovable character of the old one. But now it just keeps up with all the modern safety and emissions trends, which was, you know, when you look back at the original Mini in production for 41 years, it didn't do that.
BMW took over Rover, as you said, in 1994, and it effectively sold off all the remaining elements of the Rover business, but kept that jewel in the crown, the Mini brand. It sounds like you don't believe that the new version of the Mini they developed in the late 90s is the same car.
No, it's not the same car at all. It was a completely different design, produced from the ground up, but they aimed to sort of keep the sort of cute factor that the Mini had. And, I think they were wise to do it that way. If they created an ultra economy car in the mold of the original, they would be producing what I would call a sort of commodity product, you know, a small city car that would be selling on price. They wanted to produce a small city car that would be selling on prestige. And, So they really did set their stall out in a very different way to how the original one had been done, and I think they've been proved to be correct. It's the perfect car for the demographic of the city dweller who isn't with a small family but wants something that's still practical for the weekend and quite stylish and has a character and so on. They don't just want to buy a Nissan or a Honda or something dull. I think it is a very different car, and I think that does tend to lead to a bit of sneering from the original Mini purists, all of whom feel that possibly Isagonis's, founding principles have slightly been betrayed in the name of fashion. But there we are. You know, it has been a very spectacular, phoenix product for the British car industry, and I think we're, you know, in a way, we're very lucky to have it.
And as we look forward, I think BMW executives quite disparagingly refer to the problems in British Leyland and in Rover subsequently as the English disease, or that they couldn't cure the English patient, the industrial relations and management problems. But as we look forward, they seem to cherish the Mini brand, however you view it, as the same car, and have committed to producing electric versions of the vehicle as we go forward into transition phase of the automobile industry, and as all sorts of Brexit-related clouds hover over other foreign-owned auto manufacturing facilities in the UK.
Yes, indeed, they have. I mean, the electric version is being built here in the UK in Cowley, and they have committed to make the car there. But as to the future, the Mini being part of the British motoring fabric has always been a key selling point. But they already have a very big manufacturing plant in Holland, where many of them are built. They've made them in Austria as well. And I think if the market situation in terms of Britain's relationship with Europe was to take a fundamental a new direction, I'm not sure that the BMW of today would have the same compunction about keeping the Mini totally British as they did 20 years ago when they revived it. You know, we appear to be heading into quite a confrontational time between the car manufacturers and the politicians in this country if we leave the EU as planned, or as envisaged, with no deal. And I think that the sentiment part of the Mini, now that it's been established as a product that sells all over the world, including the States and China and Japan, that may not be enough to keep it here absolutely forever. That's just my view, you know. From the soundings I take from what car industry executives say. It's not a given that it's only going to be Britain from now on.
That obviously saddens you, Giles, not just as an obvious lover of the Mini car in all its manifestations and throughout its history, but obviously as a British citizen.
Yeah, I think it does sadden me. I'm proud of the Mini, and that's you can't help but feeling this pride in the ingenuity that came up with it. When I spent months and months locked away writing this book, I mean, you know, the thing about it is that they also made some fundamental mistakes when they brought the car out. One of which was selling it much too cheaply. All the early Minis sold in 1960-61. They lost about £30 on every car they made because they wanted to produce something so affordable that it would, you know, bring the market to them. And, you know, much as it was a brilliant design, it really did play its part in bringing down British Leyland in the 1970s, because what future generations of managers always struggled to do was make a profit with it. And so, you know, it is an amazing product, an amazing design, but it sewed in some of the basic fundamental problems of British Leyland on the very day it was launched. And so, you know, there is a sort of a bittersweet, feeling one has about it. You know, the country can be very proud of it, of the design, but, it's been a bit of a rascal in terms of, you know, running the industry into the ground, or nearly anyway.
And finally, it was judged, I think, as the second most influential motor vehicle of the 20th century, behind the Ford Model T back at the end of the 20th century.
Yeah, that must have been an American survey, not a British one.
Why so?
Well, you know, they would say that, wouldn't they? You know, I'm not sure that the Model T was as influential as the Mini has turned out to be, because the basic packaging of the Mini has been adopted by every single volume car manufacturer around the world, and that didn't happen with the Ford Model T. So it was much, much more influential than the Ford by a country mile.
Oh, in other words, you think it was the most influential car of the 20th century?
Well, if you regard influence as the effect it had on the prevailing design trends of all other vehicles, then I would say yes. The Ford Model T, if you ever sit in one, doesn't have the pedals in the right place. So it has lots of factors which did not continue to appear in subsequent sort of waves of car design.
And forgive my ignorance, Giles, but is it, along with the Volkswagen Beetle, the only car through all sorts of challenges and tribulations and changes of ownership and fundamental design, as you point out, is it the only car that it is still, some version of it is still being made 60 years later?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. It's from in terms of a single design lasting for the longest time, I think it's probably been beaten by the Land Rover, you know, the traditional Land Rover Defender, because that has a lineage that starts in 1948 and pretty much continues untrammeled until 2016. So, you know, Britain did come up with something else that was, you know, we let it you know, wither on the vine for even longer. But, you know, the Volkswagen Beetle had a very long a period in production, you know, 1945 to 2003. So, you know, there's a sort of slew of vehicles which appeared after the Second World War, which were so absolutely perfect for what they were setting out to do that they proved very, very difficult to replace. And the Mini's in that sort of elite club, for better or worse.
Okay, we'll leave it there. That's Giles Chapman, an award-winning writer on the history, industry and culture of cars and author of Mini 60 Years. Giles, thanks indeed for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're joined now by Professor Francis Rouen, former director of the Economic and Social Research Institute here. Francis, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Francis, we're going to talk about the whole issue of Scottish independence and whether there's a greater likelihood again now of that happening sometime in the future because of the way the whole Brexit issue is going. You're a former member of the Scottish Administration's Council of Economic Advisers, I think appointed in 2010, and appointed back in 2016 to a panel of experts to advise that administration in Edinburgh on the implications of the Brexit referendum result back in 2016. How did you develop that relationship with Scotland, firstly?
So first of all, it actually was 2007 that I went on. So I did three terms, 2007 to 2010. So the second one you picked up was the second term. Alex Salmond, who was the first minister at the time, this SNP had come in with the majority in Scotland, and they decided that they may well go for a more independent economic strategy than they'd done previously. So he appointed this Council of Economic Advisers. Of a lot of people were Scots living outside Scotland. They were academics, they were business people, some in Scotland, some outside, and some people who weren't Scottish at all, and I was one of those. And I think because Salmond was very aware of the Irish growth system and what we'd done over the years, and he was anxious to have somebody from that kind of perspective. So the council met about three times a year. He spent the day with the council. We discussed a lot of the long-term issues like demographics, like education in Scotland, early school leaving, the need to innovate, and also a concern they have, which is one we've always had, which is on the regional distribution of economic activity, because some of the older industries had obviously closed and other industries were opening up. So it was a kind of like a sort of three times a year brainstorming, and the civil servants then sort of took from that and policies were developed, ideas were generated from that structure. So that went on, and I was reappointed in 2010 and then again in 2013. And then just prior to the Brexit referendum, there was a decision made that they wanted to strengthen their links with Europe. They fully expected, I mean, I was talking to them the day before, they fully expected that it would be a Remain vote.
I suppose they weren't on their own there.
And they weren't on their own there. And of course, in Scotland, that was absolutely right. They were wanted to remain. So they were going to set up a council, a standing council on Europe, to see how they would further develop their relationship with Europe. And then, of course, that turned into a very different council, which I was appointed to, but it was doing a different thing, which was how to cope with what Brexit meant for Scotland.
And let's focus on that for the moment, because just to remind ourselves, the 2014 referendum that did take place on Scottish independence, I suppose defeated fairly decisively in the end, 55-45. But recent polls seem to suggest that the level of support, at least in principle, for another go at Scottish independence is growing there because of the impact of English nationalism on the whole Brexit debate and how Brexit may unfold in terms of a disorderly departure by the UK.
So I'm not involved there at the moment. I ceased to be involved at the end of 2017. But what I certainly would be very much aware of was that already at that point and on the Standing Council, there was a sense that Scotland's future was being determined without Scotland in mind. And the First Minister was very articulate on that. Inevitably, that meant people became more aware of, well, hold on a minute, who is determining our future? We want this. And I mean, I think it's fair to say that the treatment of the Scottish First Minister by the Prime Minister at the time in London was not such as to look as if their views were being respected, their challenges being respected. And of course, we all know that when you make a change like this, the regional distributions of it are going to be enormous. And Scotland was definitely going to be negatively affected. And they were already beginning to, I mean, they knew that in advance, which is why they would have been pro-Remain. But, you know, as that became clearer, they realised the impact would be very significant for them.
And, of course, more than 60% of those who voted in Scotland voted to Remain.
Indeed, voted to Remain. So I think it's very fair to say that people are beginning to rethink again. They were expecting, I mean, after the independence debate worked out that they were going to stay part of the UK. I mean, the discussions around that had been very informed by promises that were being made from Westminster about greater devolution, other things that were going to happen. There was some queries, you know, in relation to how their, you know, currency would work out if they were independent. So a lot of the uncertainty that was created there, I think, did probably have an impact on the numbers on the day. But that's now being rethought, because you're now looking at who was this person, who was this kind of group of people in London who were going to support us in what we were going to do. And now they don't seem to be taking our interests into account at all.
So if and ever that does come to another poll, and I know the Scottish Parliament is already planning to legislate for another referendum, possibly as early as next year or the year afterwards. But if it does come to another poll, the economic barriers to Scotland pulling out of the UK, whether to launch on its own independently or to remain within the EU or a combination of both, the economic barriers haven't gone away and in fact have perhaps become compounded since 2014, not least of which the fact is that the rest of the UK, England in particular, remains its largest trading partner. I think about £50 billion of exports annually from Scotland south of the border, only £15 billion to the rest of the EU.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. The UK leaving Europe has made it more difficult for Scotland. Because if you like, the single market was a framework which allowed companies, individuals, companies to trade, individuals to move, all sorts of activities to take place with great freedom. So you didn't lose any connection into the UK by doing more into Europe. And as I said, they were planning to be more engaged with Europe, but they weren't planning to disengage from England at that juncture. So I think the challenge is very significant as to how they would do it. And I suppose it really depends then on what is the final Brexit agreement, because if that structure could more or less support them or could work the other way around.
Yes, so I suppose ironically, while certain the Conservative governments push towards a hard Brexit supported by those who want an extreme Brexit in England, while their push to that is increasing sentiment for independence in Scotland, the fact that the UK could be a third country outside the EU would actually create a hard border like in Ireland.
And if you remember from the get-go, Nicola Sturgeon came out with the issue that they wanted a soft Brexit. They respected the fact that they were part of the UK and that vote had been there, but they wanted a soft Brexit. And I suspect, clearly, if they want to have any greater independence in the future, that's what they will seek to want to have. And the difficulty is we seem to be heading in exactly the opposite direction. So it's very challenging for them. I think the stop-go has obviously affected people, companies in Ireland as well, in terms of, is this going to happen? Is this not going to happen? I think in Scotland, I suspect that's equally strong because, you know, if you're an small business, and this has been talked about, but nothing's actually happened, how much time do you invest in it? You get on with the other part of the business. So it's not clear in a lot of areas how much the SMEs, how well prepared the SMEs are, particularly as you say, their main exports are to England. So the extent to which it's a smaller portion going out to Europe, we're slightly different. We've even more going out to Europe than they have. So for us, it makes for an individual business, it makes it more sensible to be engaged.
The other, I suppose, difficult obstacles that have perhaps even become more protracted since 2014 is the question of which currency an independent Scotland would use. And I suppose that there's more focus on that now as the UK plans to leave the EU. And then the whole question of, you know, how would an independent Scotland balance its budgets, particularly with oil revenues falling?
And that was one of the situations that was somewhat different in the early sort of 2012, 2013, where the oil revenues were higher. And that was seen as one of the ways of trying to balance the books. No matter what way you look at it, that would be a huge challenge for Scotland in terms of how to do it. And it seems to me that without the goodwill from Westminster at some level, it was going to be always very, very difficult. Now, there'd been quite a lot of devolution, as you know, since 2000. And the question was, should it go in a steady kind of way? And it was the SNP majority that led Alex Salmond to decide, let's go for it now, I suppose. Every First Minister wants to do it in their day. When it didn't pass, the expectation would have been before Brexit that this would not come on the agenda for another 10 to 15 to 20 years. It's kind of a generational piece. And that was, I think, to some extent, the way people were working. I think as the Brexit story has panned out, people are looking at it again. But the issue of the currency is still a big issue for them. Because unless I just think the idea of setting up as a separate currency in today's world does not make sense. You'd be far too open to stresses and strains.
And apart from anything else, if there was political goodwill in Brussels to try and help an independent Scotland stay in the EU, and that's not a given, given the whole separatist debate in yeah, in Spain and elsewhere, but if there was, Scotland couldn't automatically join the euro. They would have to show that they had the fiscal resources and the fiscal discipline to earn becoming a eurozone member.
Absolutely. And so the question then you get back to is the strength of the Scottish economy. And as an economy, it has a lot of older industry. It has adjusted in many, some areas, and is doing very well in some of the biotech areas. It's drawn in quite a bit of foreign direct investment in recent times, but nothing on the scale that we would have done. Some of its sort of biopharma that I would have seen, because we would have been brought around to the universities and we would have seen some of the plants that were there when I was on the council. I mean, they're very embedded. It's a very well thought through system. They're very good, actually, policy makers at the micro level. They don't do macro policy because obviously that's been controlled out of Westminster. But historically, they've been very thoughtful in what it is they're doing. And there's a lot of joined up thinking. They make probably more, my experience was that they were more willing to make tough strategic decisions than we might be here. So part of the economy, I think the modern part, is actually quite good. Then they have obviously got food and alcohol is a big, our big exports. But they're very important for them in terms of revenue outside of the English market.
As you say, certainly from our view here, probably more of a dependence, although that's changing, on traditional hard industries like shipbuilding, which is changing. The one thing they do have, though, is a very strong and progressive education system, don't they? And particularly at third level.
They've a very good education system generally. The difficulty they've had, which Northern Ireland has had similarly, and which we have, I think, been really quite successful in doing, is they have a lot of early school leavers, and then what are called, you know, NEETs, young people who are not in employment education, EET, or training. So they have actually a very high number of people in that area. They've a lot of hands-on ways of dealing with it. Their third level system is centred on a 4-year degree rather than a 3-year degree. It tends to lead to very good quality graduates. And certainly that has been very good for them in attracting industry in. One of the things that Alex Salmond was very keen on, I mean, I think he saw it happening in Ireland in the early part of this century, was that people were coming in, foreigners were attracted, found Ireland, found Dublin, found Cork, found Limerick, Galway, attractive places to be. And he was very keen to try to open Scotland up because its demographics are not good. It has basically a declining natural population. So getting foreigners in was a really big part of that strategy. And that's where Brexit hurts as well.
I was going to put that to you, that I was just looking at the population of Scotland and it is at best static, about 5.4 million, whereas ours is growing, you know, now pushing close to 5 million. And that the only real population growth in recent times has been from immigrants coming in who bring a different type of resource to the economy as well.
Absolutely. I mean, the when on the Council of Economic Advisers, we had some of these discussions. This would have been sort of prior to the independence and prior to the Brexit referendum, obviously. But one of the things that came up was a lot of Scottish students go outside Scotland to get their degrees. And then the question was, they're attracted by London, the sort of city lights. And we had these long discussions of strategising how to get them back. What would it take to get them back? And they were more likely to come back, as often we found in Ireland, when they have children. Mm. So then the question was, how good were the Scottish cities at receiving people back in? How were the school system? So there was a lot of joined up thinking in how they thought these things through. But they really also felt that, you know, some of, I suppose, just for Scotland as a country, having more foreigners was itself an enriching experience, which they hadn't had previously and which they really want to get more of. So having foreign students coming in and staying on. So they were giving them options to take work after that. And this was under negotiation. How long could these people stay?
And which may now be under threat because of the UK's immigration policy.
So for them, the EU freedom of movement was a plus, whereas as far as London was concerned, freedom of movement was a negative.
It seems to me from just visiting Scotland that, you know, a country, if it was standing on its own, more or less the same size as us geographically, more or less the same size population-wise, a lot more densely populated in the two big cities, Glasgow and Edinburgh. But it seems to me that it's probably a more class-bound society than ours for historical reasons. It seems to have more extreme urban deprivation. And it seems, from what you're suggesting, that perhaps less open to change than we have been, perhaps through necessity.
I think we've had a huge benefit of having a lot of out migration and in migration, because we've had Irish people who've gone abroad, they've come back, they've had their minds opened up, they interact with people when they come. We've got the people who come in, and we've been hugely positive about net immigration. And I think long may it remain so. I think it's an enormously positive. They hadn't had that experience, and you're right, there would be tended to be a concentration in a very small number of areas of actually the immigrants. I was at, before the Scottish independence referendum, I happened to be staying with friends in rural Scotland in Galloway, and we went to a kind of public meeting on the issue of independence. And you could certainly see that the people who were very much pro-Remain, and this would have been particular area, very middle class, very, very, very traditional, wouldn't have been open to anything that looked like a change at all. And then going back, I knew people who were canvassing, some Irish people actually went over to canvass for independence in some of the working class areas in Glasgow. And they remarked on the fact that they saw levels of deprivation they had never seen in Ireland. They were just completely taken aback. So there's a big challenge for them there. We had lots of discussions on this income disparity and how it should be dealt with. And Scotland, as a policy framework, thought a lot about place, something which we've gone back to doing now with our spatial plan here in Ireland. But they were very big on thinking about place because they saw that the deprivation was pockets, was spatial pockets of places, usually where shipbuilding had closed down or where an industry, coal mining or whatever, had closed down. So they were very aware of place as a way of thinking about policy. And I think that issue is still a huge agenda item for them.
In the end, whatever happens in terms of Brexit, Francis, and how quickly a second referendum may emerge, in the end, this will probably boil down to money and whether most Scots feel they will be better in the long run, independent or part of the United Kingdom in some way. And there is this annual debate when these statistics are published in August, the so-called GERS statistics, I think Government Expenditure and Revenue Scotland, as to how dependent Scotland is on the rest of the UK, whether there is more public spending in Scotland than in England in particular, whether they are overly dependent on oil revenues. Of course, the Scots would say all sorts of expenditures would go, including the nuclear deterrent and other defence measures. But it is a big debate and it's not clear just how sound the Scottish budget is.
And I think really, therefore, what matters crucially is what's happening to economic growth in Scotland and productivity in Scotland. Is it increasing? So there's a very interesting piece that I became very conscious of, both on a committee I was on in Northern Ireland, but in the committee in Scotland, which was... the data showed that productivity and earned income was much lower relatively in Scotland and indeed in Northern Ireland than it was in London. So one way of looking at that was that the South was making huge transfers to the North to make its living standards possible. But then that became turned the other way around, I think, in the Brexit debate, that it was almost as if the South had grabbed everything at the expense of the North. So that issue of income disparity across regions in the UK, I think, is a really big one. And you can look at it, as I say, in two completely different ways. One is the South is supporting the North and keeping it going. But the other issue is that the South has somehow or other, that the economic policy has favoured the South at the expense of the North. But actually, really what's happened is that globalisation and the way the world went meant that an awful lot of activity shipped to the South. The one place that Scotland did have a very strong benefit prior to the economic crash, of course, was it has a very strong financial sector. And that financial sector is now trying to link into the Irish financial sector, realising that you can build some synergies between Scotland and Ireland. But a lot of the other sectors would be ones that would be in decline rather than in terms of would be ones of growth.
As a keen observer and visitor to Scotland over the last 12 years now, do you think it will happen? Do you think we'll see an independent Scotland of some sort over the next 10 years? Do you think they can become one of the more vibrant, independent nations within the EU and a partner and an economic competitor to us?
So I think there's a number of questions there. I think, I mean, let me put it this way. I would be very surprised if there aren't papers in the Scottish government which make it clear what they would do the next time round. I'm quite sure that just hasn't disappeared off the agenda. They would be very aware of if we were going to go, what would be the economic issues that came up the last time, how would we deal with them? So I'm quite sure that work has been done. I think the issue then of whether they can grow economically enough to do that, as I say, I could see some positives, but I could also see less flexibility than in some areas here, where I think we've achieved really quite a lot. And we've also had a style of policy making where I'd be quite critical of it at one level, but another level, it gets things across the line more easily than they could. But the big issue is the third question you raised there. What would Europe's view be in relation to Scotland coming in as a separate currency? I would find it, I think that's the biggest challenge. I think the idea the last time of actually staying linked to the UK currency was the right one, but it would be a hard one to stack now, given the history of what's happened in the intervening period. So to the extent that that a soft Brexit achieves a framework that allows them to connect into Europe in somewhat of a different way, I think that might be where their best chance would be.
As complicated a landscape as a tartan kilt.
Yes, absolutely.
We leave it there. Professor Francis Rouen, former director of the Economic and Social Research Institute in here in Ireland and former economic advisor to the Scottish administration. Francis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're joined now by Miguel Delaney, chief football writer with The Independent in the UK. Miguel, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Bury Football Club, one of the oldest professional clubs in the world, expelled from the English Football League this week due to financial insolvency and an inability to pay creditors and indeed players. We'll come to the specifics of why this might have happened, Bury specifically, in a few minutes, Miguel, and indeed it could have happened to its neighbouring club, Bolton, as well. But Bury is a town 10 miles from the Etihad Stadium, home of Manchester City, now one of the richest clubs in the world. And you've written that this growing dichotomy in wealth amongst English Football League clubs and the media profile that it's generated is slowly killing league football at the lower levels.
Yeah, I think it's a number of factors, but I suppose if you want to really tie it all together, it's basically just the way football has embraced almost this ultra-capitalism to an extent. And it's created this cycle where more and more interest goes towards the top clubs, which means more and more money goes towards the top clubs. And like the way I put it in the piece I did in May, which basically cites some government studies which predict that 75% of League One and League Two clubs will basically be unable to exist in their current form in the next 5 years, is that basically creates a drag, both in terms of expenditure, which clubs down the pyramid can't keep up with, and also interest, which means they can't generate the same money. I mean, a huge demographic problem in English football. And actually, to be fair, I think this is something we've already seen foreshadowed in Ireland, with the kind of, I suppose, going right back to when Match of the Day was first shown in Ireland, kind of the glamour of the English league was illustrated at the expense of the local league. But it basically means that a lot of these local clubs, as was put to me, the old lad-dad culture is broken down because of the way the game is consumed now, because of the kind of the dominant media image of the top clubs, the next generation of supporters aren't going to the lower league clubs. The top clubs are consuming everything. And it has kind of brought us to a point now where it's all beginning to break apart, and the game is, the pyramid of the game is unsustainable in that way.
And when you talk about the drag effect of that pyramid and the impact of what's happening at the top, part of the financial, the structural financial problems being experienced at lower levels is that club owners, club directors are spending beyond their means to pay players to try to get to the next league up, and it's just unsustainable.
That's pretty much it. I mean, that is what it comes down to. I mean, I was talking to Mark Palios about this, who's former chairman of the Football Association and now the owner of Tranmere. And he's basically trying to build a self-sustainable community club. And I think, as he put it, where the survival of the club is agnostic to results. And it's all organic, which I suppose isn't the case in a lot of clubs. And this is also another issue, I suppose, that ultimately we have 92 clubs, and it's more than 92 clubs because the amounts that are in non-league and have come through the actual Football League structure over the 150 years of professional football in England. But a lot of these are kind of built almost on a Victorian model now, and that can't really survive in this modern age. Well, obviously, at the top, and more modern than anything, is what the Premier League is, and particularly what the Big Six are in England. And that does have an effect right the way down, in that it's just, I mean, even if you look at it in quite basic terms, it was put to me, if you look at a club in the Championship, say, the tier just below the Premier League, so a team that gets relegated from the Premier League, the promised land and all the rest of it, they get parachute payments of about that amount to about 100 million in total, and they're going up against a team in the other end, a potential club in the other end, like Tranmere went up, in which when it gets promoted from League One, say, where the differences in budget are so vast, it's almost incomprehensible. And the gap in one division alone just creates, as Palios put it, this huge drag and these effective tank traps that clubs keep putting through. Now, again, I suppose this is where other issues come into it, like who owns clubs, the running of clubs. And this is another problem with football and the structure at the moment, is that there's a complete lack of regulation. And even this week, I think a lot of fingers can be pointed at the Football League, because you know they allowed the situation to bury an owner like this. And there's been absolutely no suggestion, even in the wake of this tragedy in a club basically eventually going bust for the first time since 1992, there's been no suggestion of any sort of independent investigation to see how this has come about and what can be done.
You point to demographic change as one of the key reasons for this slow death at the lower ends of the league, Miguel. Partly, I suppose, because, as you say, supporters, particularly younger supporters, are drawn to the glamour of the big clubs and would prefer to watch them at home on television in their Manchester United or Chelsea jerseys rather than go to their local club. But there's also just the structural change of what younger people are into now. They're more into a digital experience of something like football rather than actually going along.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was talking to people who were working with the British government with clubs on the basis basically that, and I think this is really important going forward, even beyond football to society, that in a lot of towns, a lot of places like Rochdale and Portsmouth, the club is actually one of the few surviving social hubs where you actually kind of get large portions of the community coming across each other, linking. And that's actually proven very useful to authorities, to police. Yeah, they've found that the age profile is not getting younger, because one of the things I was pointing out, I was putting you by someone in government, basically, there's nothing to suggest the current younger generation will, I suppose, go with these clubs in the future, because the group basically from 10 to 25 years old, they usually support a top six club, or if not a top six club, I found this interesting even when the weekend of the Community Shield, which is Liverpool Manchester City, was also obviously the opening weekend of the Football League in general when the Championship, League One, League Two starts. And I live in Battersea in London, and I think it's telling that I was struck by people wearing jerseys of clubs like Plymouth, Preston that had fixtures that weekend, instead of clubs like Real Madrid or Paris Saint-Germain. Like in London alone, I'm much more used to seeing the latter, the big glamour clubs, than the traditional local clubs. But another thing was put into, they don't, a lot of kids, they just, so first of all, they've been priced out of a lot of games, and even at a lower league level, and again, we come back to the running clubs, basically, these clubs have to put up prices. I mean, even to get into a League One, League Two game can often be about £25. Which over the course of a season, obviously, and even with a season ticket, can be very expensive. And they have to do that, of course, to keep up with this financial drag. So the whole culture of going to games in that way, and especially going to your local club, is becoming alien to a younger generation. But also there's a more basic thing where it was put to us that basically they're much more interested in consuming football on WhatsApp or electronically. Because then they can, rather than being at the game, and you're basically just consuming the match as it goes on instead. If they're online, you know, they can immediately respond to clips, everything that comes out. And I suppose this is the thing, there's a quote-unquote banter element with their friends, but online rather than at the stadium.
That experience you had on the Community Shield day where you saw fans going to the match with their own local club jerseys on, it's almost like a GAA thing here in Ireland. They want to show where they're from, but they're not necessarily supporting where they're from.
This is the thing, yeah. I think it's quite, Ireland really foreshadowed the problems in England by about 20, 30 years, which is what the struggles around the League of Ireland, the domestic league, has had to get people to ground in the face of the onslaught of the Premier League on our doorstep. And it's not just Ireland's experience, it's also, I've heard similar stories in in Nigeria and basically any country where the Premier League permeates. And I suppose, I think people could fairly point to, there's an element of hypocrisy from people like myself and the media in this, because we do feed the cycle. But there's also a dilemma there, because, part of the media has to cover what people are interested in, which is invariably the top six. Yet, again, I suppose that just permeates what's happening, because more coverage creates more interest, which is, it keeps going and going and going. And to the case now where, even pieces like I've done on the lower leagues, just like the jerseys, almost stand out in the face of so much visibility of the big Premier League clubs and big European clubs. I feel like just because of the Champions League and the nature of media coverage, I've been to the Bernabeu more times in, I think, the last 2 years than I have been to Selhurst Park, which is a Premier League club at Crystal Palace, and are very close to me, just because the nature of coverage and having to go to the bigger games.
And giving that self-fulfilling process then, I suppose, of more and more money going into the game at the top, not just in England but across Europe, and more media coverage, I suppose, attracting then the supporting financial sponsorship and TV rights to those clubs. And given the demographic changes that you've referenced there, Miguel, is it just the case then that in modern England there are too many football clubs? I mean, I was looking at the map of Northern England myself last night, and a lot of these old names come up. Bury and Bolton are side by side, two struggling clubs, not far from Rochdale, only 20 miles along the road to Huddersfield and Oldham are in there. There's just too many clubs given all those changes.
I mean, that actually is a fair argument, yes. And some of it comes down to the culture of English football. Right? If you look at places like, if you look basically across all of Europe, where they have much more of a history of clubs going bust, but also a history of clubs going bust banding together to form other clubs. I mean, one of the most famous in Italy, Sampdoria, in the Champions League final in 1992, they're an amalgamation of a series of clubs. And I suppose it leads to the case where in other mega football countries like Spain and Italy, they really only sustain about 38 to 40, professional clubs in that way. Certainly the English structure is unique and the Northwest is unique. I mean, as you point there, the Northwest of England is almost like it's the cradle of civilization in football terms. It's where the game first exploded. Also, even if you look at the map of the distribution of league clubs, for the first quarter of a century of football. I mean, the Football League started in 1888 with Bolton as one of the founding members, of course, of their own division last week. And it wasn't until 1904 that there was even a club from London in the league, which was Woolwich Arsenal, the current Arsenal. Because there was such a dominant preponderance of clubs from the Northwest. And, again, this comes back to, I suppose, Victorian structures in the modern age that, because of the interest of the time and sort of local identities, these clubs naturally grown up. Where we're now at a point where the nature of modern society just runs against that. And it could be argued that, I mean, really since, I suppose, the 1950s, where football was still, you could almost say it was still in its first stage. But since the 1950s, Manchester United have been one of the biggest clubs in England, if not Europe, and always kind of dominant. But what's also changed beyond wider technological and demographic forces in the last few years is that Manchester City have become a global club as well, because they're basically taken over by an Abu Dhabi owner and are essentially a vehicle of Abu Dhabi's foreign policy. But that has, I suppose, created further pressure on the local clubs in that area and clubs like Bury who are so close.
Anybody watching British television during the week and the way Bury were kicked out could see the raw emotion expressed by people from Bury, supporters of Bury, people crying as if it was a death in the family. And you've pointed that to that community role, that heritage role that clubs play in a lot of towns that have very little else going on. But in the end, football clubs are businesses run by business people, some good business people, some bad business people. Is it fair to replace that responsibility of some sort of social onus as well on these businesses?
Well, see, this is the fundamental contradiction of football, I suppose, is that they're treated like business when in reality they actually are social institutions. And I do find it staggering that English authorities, be that either on the football side or even on a governmental basis, never looked in to offer it to ring fencing clubs in this way. I mean, in the piece I did on the owners back at the start of August, I think it's actually quite stark. If you look at the situation of Roman Abramovich at Chelsea, before he bought Chelsea, he basically went around Europe looking to buy some of the biggest clubs, and he found he couldn't buy Bayern Munich, he couldn't buy Real Madrid, he couldn't buy Barcelona because they were all ring fenced. Bayern Munich are in Germany, so they have that issue where there's 51% of the clubs have to be kind of fan ownership. And with Real Madrid and Barcelona, we're actually kind of remarkable in the modern age, really. But despite all the problems with those clubs, it remains creditable. Is the fact that they're completely owned by members of the clubs who are also fans. And that is the situation. England, instead, has this free-for-all. I mean, some of this goes back to how clubs were first organised in the 1880s, but it also goes back, I think, more fundamentally here, and not coincidentally, to the Thatcherite politics of the 1980s, where used to be the FA used to have a rule in place which basically prevented directors taking money out of the club or dividends being paid out. And in the 1980s, Spurs, I don't have the specific details in front of me here, but broadly, in the 1980s, Spurs wanted to float on the stock market, essentially, so they could grow as a club. To do that, they had to set up a separate company out of that. And this was just waved through. While the old rules, I think it was Rule 28, stayed in place, it meant it could be sidestepped. And it grew into this this gradual free-for-all and the growth of the Premier League. And that's actually, I mean, one of the things in all of this that's been, there's a lot of talk about how, you know, Premier League clubs should help the likes of Bury and Bolton. There should be more money passed on. When actually, the entire foundation of the Premier League, its entire purpose, was basically to create more money for fewer clubs and essentially to take them apart from the rest of the English football structure. So it's almost like it's a grim irony that they'd be asked to kind of pump the money in to save these clubs. But as well as that, it wouldn't actually be a structural solution.
Is there any danger, Miguel, that we could overstate the significance of what happened Bury during the week? Because in the end, only two or three clubs have been expelled from the English League due to financial insolvency over the last 30 years or so. So it is a rare enough occurrence, although a lot of them get into trouble and are then bailed out one way or the other. And also Bury was just run by what looks like a complete charlatan, Steve Dale, who didn't meet the basic compliance of proving he could fund a team for a year. And on BBC Radio acknowledged he didn't know where Bury was, he didn't know it had a football team, and he thought their supporters were drunk and loud, said ultimately it was a business run by a very disreputable businessman.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what it comes back to. I mean, yes, that is a case with its own specific problems, but even those specific problems come from a wider context that, you know, every club is now suffering, because Bury are far from the only club suffering from questionable owners. They're far from the only club with financial problems. And really, one of the reasons that Dale was even in there in the first place is because Bury were already stretched to the limit. I think this is going to become a significant trend. You know, you're right. This is the first club expelled since 1992, so in that sense, it's a rare occurrence. But I think it's very quickly going to become the norm. You look at Bolton, who were just in the Premier League 7 years ago. You know, it seems now they've just been saved really by the skin of their teeth. We've got similar problems at Morecambe, Oldham, Blackburn Rovers, Coventry City, Southend United, and Leighton Orient. I think this is going to become a much bigger issue. But also, I think the natural direction of football. I know this has been brought up a lot over the last 30 years, that it's always been there in the distance and never actually happened at the European Super League. But as with fears about clubs going bust, I think that's something that's going to rapidly advance in the last few years, just because it's what the very structure of football can only sustain, really, which will be a little like the NFL in America, I suppose, a kind of a hyper elite, super glamorous top level, which is a European Super League, basically, and then a much, much smaller middle tier, where at the moment England obviously has a massive middle tier with those 92 clubs, and then basically a huge, huge grassroots movement, which will involve a lot of fan-owned, you know, organic community clubs, kind of in the model of AFC Wimbledon, but I suppose much more spread out.
And with those huge forces in terms of money, demographic and technological change that we've talked about, what is the best solution in the short term to try and preserve as many of these clubs as possible, if that's the right thing to do? Is it that perhaps, like the NFL, as you purposed, that there would be greater distribution of player resource and indeed money from the Premier League down into it? Is it that there would be better regulation by the English Football League itself, or that the type of people who get to run English football clubs are regulated by some independent third party?
Yeah, I think there needs to be much stronger regulation from the Football League, particularly in regard to how clubs run and principally in terms of who owns the club. But so the issue there is that the horse is bolted in so many ways, or in so many different areas. And I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot, but it almost feels like I'm very resistant to the idea of a Super League. Obviously, clubs like Bury going bust is fundamentally a terrible thing. And yet these worst-case scenarios might actually be the best things for the game. Because even at a club like Bury, it's going to give the supporters the chance to, I suppose, you know, rebuild, you know, create their own club, although appropriating the identity of Bury, as it has happened in the past, has happened with Aldershot in 1992, and create a much more sustainable club, you know, unanchored to the problems they've previously had. And if a Super League was to take place, then I suppose it immediately kind of solves a lot of issues. Now it will take away this drag in the game. So it's almost like these worst case scenarios are necessary to save the integrity of football, if you like. Because at the moment, like I don't think, you know, as the game has never been more popular. I think David Goldblatt has a book coming out in the next month, and I was at a talk with him at the start of August. Funnily enough, also that Community Shield weekend at the event in London, and like he makes a very fair argument that in the history of the globe, there has actually never been a cultural force as pervasive as football. Like, not even right down to, like, you know, music of Elvis, the Beatles. It actually hasn't crossed as many borders as football has now. So despite that ultra popularity, it's that ultra popularity that actually created a more intense interest in just the top end. And we have problems with that all over the world, basically. Loads of failing national leagues. And even at the biggest leagues, you have clubs like Bayern Munich, Juventus, Paris Saint-Germain, Barcelona, and now probably Manchester City, who are just kind of like, you know, competitions that have previously been so vibrant and healthy, and they're basically just dominated by one super, you know, super wealthy club. So it's like something has to change in that regard. The game is at once extremely healthy with so much money in it, and on the other end, it's not really healthy at all with that money causing problems.
Fascinating topic, and not just about sport, much wider than that. We leave it there. That's Miguel Delaney, Chief Football Writer with The Independent in the UK. Miguel, thanks a million for joining us.
Cheers. No problem at all.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings on the new Go Loud app, available to download now in the App Store or on Spotify and the Apple Podcast Player. So just search for Taking Stock and you can find us there. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our six AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.